The Rad Podcast is brought to you by MOFO, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, mind-blowing nut butter blend, now offered on Amazon. Chili Technology, temperature-controlled mattress systems for a good night's sleep. InsideTracker.com, offering blood, DNA, and fitness tracking data all in one place. And Organifi, whole food organic superfood supplements and drink blends. And please visit the shopping page at bradkearns.com for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance with great discounts for listeners. Here we go with the show.
If your cortisol, which is your stress hormone, is, you know, consistently activated, you're going to have a lot of difficulty losing weight. I respond poorly to even like quinoa or sweet potato and some fruit. So I just have to work with manipulations on how to process these things. But if I were to not pay attention to these things, then, you know, this would likely progress into a more severe disease state or insulin resistance down the road. In my case, for example, you know, I may have a, you know, smaller degree of insulin resistance because I cannot tolerate that carbohydrate well, so it's just earlier signs of it, whereas someone who is metabolically healthy, they can tolerate it well.
Hey folks, how about a non-drinker telling you what kind of alcohol you should drink? That's right, it's pseudo-sommelier Brad Kearns here to recommend dry farm wines. Why? Because if you choose to drink, I want you to be healthy and make a superior choice to the mainstream commercial wines. Listen to my podcast with Dry Farm Wines founder Todd White. The insights were astonishing, especially that most all commercial wines are loaded with dozens of chemicals that the FDA allows in your wine but don't have to be listed on the label. And the sugar, oh my goodness, the sugar levels can be as much or more per liter than Coca-Cola, but difficult to taste due to the acidity in the wine. Dry Farm Wines is a membership club where you're shipped hand-picked wines from old-world family-run vineyards in France, Italy, Greece, and Sicily. These wines come from non-irrigated vineyards hundreds of years old that deliver a tastier, higher antioxidant grape, and they're independent lab certified to be completely free from chemical additives and naturally 100% sugar-free. That's right, the sugar was allowed to ferment out instead of be arrested by chemical intervention in the name of pleasing the average consumer palate that has a sweet tooth. The Dry Farm Wines Club has taken off like crazy because ancestral and keto enthusiasts, people who care about their health, appreciate a sugar-free wine. You'll enjoy the variety, the taste, and the pleasant sensation in the aftermath of burning through the alcohol buzz and going on with your life without a hangover. So if you care about your carb intake and your overall health, Dry Farm Wines has a special promotion for podcast listeners. Get your first bottle for a penny when you enroll at dryfarmwines.com/Brad or click on the Dry Farm Wines at the bradkearns.com shopping page. Cheers. Hey, listeners, here comes another extremely informative and interesting show about glucose and the wonderful new technology of the continuous glucose monitor. I have Molly Downey, dietitian from NutriSense, on the line. We're going to get all deep into this important subject. I think it's one of the great breakthroughs in technology and self-quantification that I've seen in years. Most of the stuff I have no use for, no interest in. I think we kind of overanalyze every little thing in life. And so you'll see me working out without even a watch or worrying about too many of the biofeedback tools. Same with sleep. I can't imagine tracking my sleep because I'd start thinking about it instead of falling asleep. But with continuous glucose meter, that you attach to your body, a tiny little sensor that goes on your arm, and then the smartphone app, you can track your blood glucose over a sustained period of time. Each trip through the sensor takes 2 weeks. And so you sign up for 2 months or 3 months or whatever you want, and you have all this data to see how not only your dietary choices, but all aspects of your lifestyle affect your blood glucose, that critical health metric where we want to see a good baseline average, as well as, and Molly talks about this in detail, even more important, important, then your fasting blood glucose reading, the familiar number that we get from the doctor, even more important is your ability, your postprandial glucose response, your ability to return your glucose to baseline level soon after eating a meal of any kind. And so all these things are being tracked. She's going to talk about them in detail. She's going to talk about her own personal health journey, where she was fit, she was athletic, she thought she was super healthy, she was into that plant-based diet, so she was consuming a lot of carbohydrates, and then she got into the metering and realized that she was heading down the path to prediabetes, other associated health problems, and her journey to healing began with this idea of monitoring the glucose response to meals and throughout the day, and it turned into a career for her. So I think you're going to get a lot of interesting information. This show pairs well with my previous show with Kara Collier, the co-founder of NutriSense, and that was, boy, a couple years ago now, just when the technology was just emerging. Now it's quite prevalent. They have thousands of members who are, you know, supplying more and more data so we can really learn the healthiest way to navigate our dietary choices. And perhaps most particularly, the individuality that influences our dietary choices and helps us frame all the information we're getting about whether we should be keto or paleo or carnivore or plant-based. Now we can put it to the data and see how things work for you so you can customize your optimal dietary strategy rather than just going with the flow. Good stuff from Molly Downey at NutriSense. Molly Downey, I have you on the line and the screen. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. You are one of the powerhouses behind NutriSense. It is so awesome to engage with you and the others with this incredible one-on-one support. I have to say, there's nothing like it. And I think we should start by discussing the operation, how it's grown in a short time. And then we'll talk about the intricacies of monitoring your blood glucose and what it means for health and how to improve certain markers. So first, yeah, I want to ask you, what's it like, your career? What do you do with people? And that'll be a great education.
Yeah, I'm so happy to, you know, have this discussion with you as well. I work for NutriSense, so we are a health technology company, and we leverage continuous glucose monitors, or we often refer to it as the CGM. And we use this device to offer, you know, more insight into how a person might respond, you know, metabolically to different foods, to different stressors, exercise, sleep. All of these different variables play into, you know, how your body responds. So we started, or Kara is the director of nutrition, and she started NutriSense, you know, a few years back, but we've grown, you know, progressively since then. Even since I've been with NutriSense, we were at probably 5 dietitians at that point, and now we're, you know, in the late, you know, 20s. So, you know, I think we're somewhere around 27 dietitians, but we've formed, you know, an excellent team. They're all, you know, super smart and determined, and it's just super exciting. You know, all this data is novel, and we're just beginning to, you know, get a grasp on our understanding of all of this. So it's super fascinating. It's so exciting to be a part of the NutriSense team, and right, we're our goal is to just spread health awareness, provide more insight into a person's, you know, body, right? There's so much information out there, you know, online, or you can find research to back up essentially any sort of diet, right? Whether that is, you know, keto or carnivore or plant-based, there's, you know, all this back and forth between all of that. So with NutriSense, it's humbling in the fact that we get more so a sense of that individuality, right? So not everyone's going to have, you know, the same response to stress or, you know, poor sleep or a specific food. So what we're doing is allowing the person to become more knowledgeable and educated so then they can make those informed decisions later on down the road. So it's super exciting. The technology of continuous glucose monitoring is excellent. And obviously we're still in those, you know, those infancy stages, but hopefully it'll only progress from here. But yes, it's been amazing and super exciting to see.
So previous to the consumer launch of companies like yours, this technology was in use with diabetics through medical prescription. They had to monitor their glucose. They can go hit the blood meter a bunch of times a day or put this patch on the arm. So now it's super convenient. You use a smartphone, you slap it up to your arm where the sensor is, but it's only recently become available to sort of an enthusiast who is not in disease protocol. And that's what the cool part is. And that's how you explode from a few dietitians to 27 is people on the cutting edge of health, or I suppose in that pre-diabetic window, which just encompassed 130 million Americans, right? So it's like, hey, dude, you better start paying attention to this stuff and slap this thing on your arm. And so I'm excited about it because of the potential for behavior modifications. All of a sudden, instead of one visit a year to the doctor, seeing an adverse value and then going about your busy life, now you can track all kinds of things. And I want to tee up this rant with a question, because you made a great point where you mentioned exercise, sleep, stress, all these other things. And I think we kind of, even in the really high knowledgeable health enthusiast, we kind of focus on our food choices perhaps to excess. In other words, there's so many other factors that affect our blood glucose and our health and our metabolic markers. So maybe you could talk about how some of these things, besides the pineapple hot fudge sundae that you just ate, how other things affect those glucose levels, and also what we're looking for. If you want to, you can be the next person to rant. That was a 4-part long question.
For sure. And you know, just what you said with the whole idea of, you know, focusing more so on the non-diabetic population. Most people think of glucose and it's associated with the diabetic population, right? Monitoring glucose levels is imperative, but we're putting, you know, more so of a preventative lens on it, where it can provide value to someone who, you know, isn't in that disease state, and you're able to recognize more of these, you know, the red flags aren't there, but maybe there are yellow flags that are easier to fix earlier on, or you can make, you know, minor sort of adjustments to. But of course, food is a huge implication and it promotes, you know, glucose responses. But with what you said, there are other, you know, variables as well. And, you know, if we're looking at, you know, there's different pillars of health, and, you know, we focus on sleep, we focus on stress, we focus on exercise, in addition to, you know, what we're actually eating, because all these different variables play into our overall health, and we shouldn't underestimate one, you know, and then like overemphasize another. So if someone comes in and, you know, say they're trying to lose weight or something, and their diet's great, their exercise is great, but what if their sleep is off? And what if they're completely stressed out? And, you know, if your cortisol, which is your stress hormone, is, you know, consistently activated, you're going to have a lot of difficulty losing weight. So the amazing thing about the continuous glucose monitor is that we're not just focusing on nutrition. We have all these other variables at play. So if we're looking at sleep, for example, it's definitely a fascinating thing that we can discover through continuous glucose monitoring. It's one of the trends that we see all the time. So with sleep and glucose, there is a bidirectional relationship. And what I mean by this is, you know, say that you have a poor sleep, it's very common to see elevated glucose levels overnight. So what happens is our body is recognizing this poor sleep as a stressor on the body. And what happens when the body is stressed out is there is this endogenous production of glucose. So we see that blood sugar increase, and there's also a decrease in insulin sensitivity. So if someone, you know, say I'm working with one of our members, and they, most of the time their glucose levels overnight are somewhere in, you know, the 90s range. And then I check their data, you know, one morning and their levels are more so, you know, say it hit like 110, but there's no other variables. You know, if we take out the confounding factors of, was there a meal the night before, or are you stressed? If we can zero it in on, you know, sleep, you know, your glucose levels can increase significantly because of that. And it's not only the overnight values that are impacted. So as we go into the next day, right, that stress is still going on and our bodies are fatigued. And we'll see that, you know, blood sugar regulation is not controlled as well. So we, you know, maybe you had a banana one day and, you know, in the morning after having a fantastic night's sleep and you had a great response to it, like you were able to tolerate it. But, you know, after that poor night's sleep, you might have that same exact banana at the same time and you might have a poor response to it. So we see this trend all the time that foods that are otherwise tolerated well, if you consume them after a poor night's sleep, you know, it drags on to the next day. So it's not just affecting that, you know, in that period of time, it's taking you into your next day as well. And of course, like there's other variables like mood and appetite, right? So with poor sleep, you can have, you know, an increase in, you know, hunger hormones or ghrelin and, you know, a decreased satiety hormone. So this can make it so you start eating even more. So sleep is not something that, you know, should be undermined and always, you know, I always pay attention to it because there are so many implications that come along with it. And then, you know, as I was saying, you know, sleep and glucose is bidirectional, right? So what I just explained, if you have poor sleep, you can have that increase in glucose. But also say that you have high glucose levels from a different variable. So what if you eat something later on in the evening? So say you eat like a cheeseburger and fries, and then you go to sleep 20 minutes later and your glucose is roller coastering all night in, you know, high levels, then, you know, I'll usually ask someone too, it's like, how was your sleep that night? And most of the time it's like, yeah, I was tossing and turning all night. I, you know, had crappy sleep. I didn't feel well. You know, so in that aspect, you know, the high glucose from a different variable such as food can impact your sleep as well. So it, you know, that food's acting as kind of like a stimulant to the nervous system. So it can, you know, make you more alert. So it can make it so it's more difficult to actually fall asleep and then stay asleep as well. So those are, you know, that's that bidirectional focus that we're looking at with the glucose data with sleep, but it's definitely fascinating to see.
Right. Bidirectional, bad news on both sides. And then I also assume bidirectional, if you have good glucose regulation, good dietary choices, you put your head on the pillow, your glucose has been stable for several hours, and it will continue to be as you facilitate a good night's sleep with healthy lifestyle. So there's a couple questions that come up. One of them is that the elevated blood glucose overnight, elevated from the person's norm, implies that they're stressed. Cortisol is kicking in, prompting this process of gluconeogenesis, making more blood sugar. But I know we don't make more blood glucose than we need at any one time to function. So it's going to be elevated to the point that whatever our body's asking for, even as we lay there and sleep and don't need a lot of energy. So I'm curious what's happening there. I would assume that we're down-regulating fat burning, which would be the ideal while we're sleeping, because we don't need a lot of explosive energy to lift ourselves over the bar or engage in high stress activity. So we're laying down to a crappy night's sleep because we're stressed, we're tossing and turning, we're making more glucose than I would guess is optimal at the expense of fat burning. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think like what you're trying to get at is, well, first of all, it's normal to see a glucose rise while you're sleeping. So this is not directly like a bad thing. It's a very normal trend to see. So say you're in the 80s all day and then your glucose levels as you fall asleep go into, you know, maybe the 95 range. That's not bad. That's a normal physiological process. And I can kind of go into more reasons there, but what we're looking for in overnight data, and we don't have as much evidence or research here because most of what we're looking at historically was our fasting levels. You know, if we were just doing lab data or finger prick data, someone wasn't waking up in the middle of the night, you know, testing their blood
sugar. Unless they're an Olympic athlete, then they have the World Anti-Doping Agency random unannounced testing at any time, 24/7. For normal people, no, there's no doorbell for the glucose test.
So we were missing out on this huge period of time. So that's one of the main things that someone will come in, they start testing their blood sugar and they see that increase, and it may not be bad, but they're just, you know, there's questioning about that. And there's a few reasons as to why this is happening. And I like to think of it from, you know, a circadian rhythm mindset, right? So if we're looking at what's going on throughout our day, right? If, you know, if we take melatonin, for example, melatonin is the darkness hormone. And if levels are more steady and lower, you know, naturally with melatonin during the day, it's later on at night that when the darkness starts to come in, that we see this increase in melatonin. And with melatonin, there is a decrease in the secretion of insulin and also a decrease in insulin sensitivity. So we actually see it with melatonin supplementation. So like the supplement in difference from like the actual natural hormone that's being produced endogenously. But I do see sometimes if someone's supplementing with melatonin with like higher amounts of it, that they have higher overnight values. And it's because of that mechanism where, you know, the pancreas is not, you know, producing as much, you know, insulin if there is any like food in the system or anything, or there's that decrease in insulin sensitivity at the time and glucose just naturally is arising. So that is something that I do see. And it doesn't mean that taking melatonin at night is a bad thing, right? You want to look at the big picture. And if it's improving, you know, your sleep, then I would say that that's a good thing. So, and it was just like an interesting insight that I do see sometimes with melatonin supplementation. But back to what I was saying with, you know, circadian rhythms and biology, like if you think about that process and what's going on later on at night with, you know, melatonin and, you know, we're not, you know, darkness, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, that's a time of, you know, sleep and cellular restoration. And, you know, we're not supposed to be out, you know, doing all of these things. And that's not a time that we are supposed to be eating. And we see this in the data all the time that we have most people have a significant decrease in, you know, the way that they can tolerate food later on in the evening. And, you know, it's so interesting to see it in the glucose data, you know, and some people can eat a meal later on in the evening and be able to tolerate it well. Other people, they do not do well with it at all. So I would say for the most part, carbohydrates in general, people have more difficulty processing. And that's due to that decrease in, you know, insulin sensitivity at that time. So we're less able to tolerate it. So we'll see, you know, maybe you eat we can use that banana example again, but if you eat the banana later on in the evening, you might have, you know, an exaggerated response from that. Whereas if you eat it earlier on in the day, you may not respond to it at all. And that's just because it's that time period and, you know, timing of when we're actually eating food, you know, plays a significant role. But yeah, I think I don't know what tangent I went off on, but to answer your question, yes, it's normal to see that inherent rise in glucose overnight. What we're looking at is, you know, different factors, like what's actually causing it. And like, can we work through some modifications to lower those levels? So, you know, maybe one thing would be working on your evening meal, right? So say you're like what I was saying, if you're eating that cheeseburger and fries, falling asleep right away, one of the modifications that I would suggest is, okay, let's try to eat our last meal before 6 p.m. or something, right? That's kind of just the baseline number that, you know, timing that I'll suggest. It doesn't work for everyone. Sometimes we have to push it back even further. But if you eat your meal earlier, you know, in before you go to bed, at least like 3 hours before bed, and ensuring that you know, it's low carb, right? So say they eat that low carb meal at 6 p.m. and their glucose levels were far more steady overnight, then that would be, you know, something that could be helpful for them. And, you know, if they also find that their sleep is improved in that aspect, then I would say that that is, you know, an intervention that would be helpful for that person. So there's, you know, kind of different ways that we can go about it.
So you're saying it's normal to see the individual's average glucose rise overnight, let's say higher than some of the averages during the day. And the app users, if you haven't signed up yet, you're going to sign up after the show. But if you're familiar with it, you have all this data. It seems to keep getting better with more functionality and more cute things to track. But one of them, it'll have the hourly average. So 2 a.m. every single day over the previous month, you know what your average is. And then you know what it is at 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 4 p.m. So at a glance, you can pick up all these insights and see how they apply to you directly. But I'm curious to know more about that. So back to that example of the stressed person who, you know, goes to bed in a disordered state and is tossing and turning all night, and you're seeing glucose rise above their typical average. Is that the stress response kicking in an adverse manner? And then secondly, why is it normal or why is it okay to see glucose higher overnight than a daily average or an afternoon average?
Right. So with what you were saying too, like you can look at the hourly, but we actually now have a feature in the app. So in the analytics portion, we look at sleep average. So that's like a new thing too. So I implement that a lot, but generally speaking, we like to keep it below 105 milligrams per deciliter for most people. With stress, yes, you know, that could make it so your glucose levels are elevated. And when you say, you know, why is it not necessarily a bad thing, just, and it's more so because it's an inherent, you know, physiological process that our bodies are, it's not always a significant increase in blood sugar, but you know, a slow glucose rise is something I see in mostly everyone. So that rise I'm okay with. It's when we start to see the rise, you know, that are consistently below that, above that 105 range, or, you know, we're mainly just focusing on trends and kind of what's causing it and see if, you know, you know, if it is stress, can, you know, meditation beforehand, you know, before bed, can that be helpful? You know, if you're managing your stress during the day, you know, maybe you need more exercise or so many different things. So it's kind of just working on different modifications there.
A couple of times you mentioned, we see the member doesn't do well with the banana, or back to the banana example. What does that actually, how does that play out when you say you tolerate the banana really well in the morning and then in the evening, the same banana after a busy, stressful day, whatever? Are we looking at a spike that's too prolonged that doesn't come back down? Maybe you can talk about variability now and what actually are the goals of getting this thing on our arm and getting the 10 out of 10 scores. If you're not familiar with that, listener, it does rate in different categories how well you're doing on this project. And oh my gosh, my friend Ray, who's a longtime user up in Lake Tahoe, he gets really frustrated, like if he forgot to zap it enough time and then there's a gap, and then he goes from 10 out of 10 to fours or threes because, you know, it's just the he didn't measure the data soon enough, and he blows his whole 10 out of 10 score. So lots of incentive there to look good. But what is an optimal glucose subject look like?
Good question. Yeah. So one of the major trends that we're looking at in glucose data is your postprandial or post-meal responses. So this is how you're responding to a particular food, right? So with the banana, it's not abnormal to have a glucose spike from banana, right? Since, you know, it contains carbohydrate, and, you know, glucose is a constituent of that, which causes and promotes that glucose rise. So what we're looking at is we want to keep these glucose responses within a particular threshold, right? So when we do have a glucose spike, we want to keep the peak below 100 milligrams per deciliter, because, you know, what we understand currently with research, and some people have different, you know, thresholds, but we just keep it, you know, just based off of what the research that we have now, we keep it at 140 for the generally, you know, healthy individual. If the person wants to lower it, then they can, but we do it at this, we have this peak at 140, because if our glucose levels are consistently going beyond this point, we, you know, we're more susceptible to, you know, oxidation and, you know, stress and inflammation that, you know, might be occurring. So it's important that, you know, when we're in these high ranges, that we come back down sooner rather than later. So first off, we want to avoid these high spikes in the first place. So we don't want to be going beyond threshold on a consistent basis. Secondly, we want to, if we do have these higher spikes, we want to come down in, you know, a decent amount of time. And what we deem as decent would be 2 to 3 hours. So if you do have a spike, coming back down in, you know, that 2 hour period, that would indicate to me that you have good insulin sensitivity, right? You were able to tolerate that carbohydrate well, and your body was able to adapt, bring your levels back down. If we're looking at someone who is more insulin resistant, so, you know, I see this all the time with my diabetic members. If they have a glucose response that goes beyond threshold, you know, it's going to take longer for their response to come back down to pre-meal values. So the reason being is because they're less insulin sensitive. So they have more so this insulin resistance. So their body is just having more difficulty processing that meal and, you know, getting it back to pre-meal values, you know, in more regular alignment with what glucose levels they want. So it's important, you know, and in not only someone, you know, if someone is consistently having these high blood sugar spikes beyond threshold and they're lasting, you know, 5-6 hours, you know, this would indicate to me, okay, your body's having more difficulty, you know, processing this meal. And, you know, again, what I was saying with these yellow flags, I feel like I'm the perfect example of it. I do not have, and the reason I became so interested in this in the first place is because I have horrible postprandial responses. I don't respond well to carbohydrate. And it was mind-boggling to me because I always thought of myself as, you know, a healthy person. I grew up playing sports. I was an athlete, right? I ate well. I was a dietitian, but I was not having good, you know, carbohydrate responses. And to me, I don't think at this point, you know, I don't have severe insulin resistance, but this is a huge red flag to me that something is wrong, right? And if I were to, I know now from measuring my glucose that I, you know, have to be mindful of how I incorporate carbohydrates into my diet. So it's not just, you know, processed foods like, you know, that will promote these responses. I respond poorly to even like quinoa or sweet potato and some fruit. So I just have to work with manipulations on how to process these things. But if I were to not pay attention to these things, then, you know, this would likely progress into a more severe disease state or insulin resistance down the road. So it's just like, I'm lucky enough that I already am able to recognize this and I can work on modifications. And, you know, I'm not going to be perfect. We can't be perfect, but, you know, at least I have the awareness and now I can make informed decisions about, you know, my health and how I can be proactive and, you know, making it so these issues don't, you know, come up down the road. So yeah, the postprandial or the post-meal responses is what I focus on most. And they're the easiest and fastest, you know, trends to repair, right? If we're looking at like fasting or baseline values, they're more difficult to improve. They take a lot more time, especially if there is like a hormonal issue or, you know, insulin resistance at play, like that can take a long time to kind of budge. But the postprandial responses, like you can just make minor adjustments to, you know, you can either pair the carbohydrate with a protein, or you can, you know, lower the carbohydrate amount in the meal, or, you know, different people respond differently to different types of carbohydrates. So there's ways to kind of work around it. But again, we want to avoid those high spikes, hitting those high levels that are staying up there for a long period of time, because that's what's going to induce that, those negative, you know, consequences like inflammation and oxidative stress. So that's, you know, kind of the reasoning as to why we're looking at the variability there.
So in your case, did you have noticeable adverse symptoms that you're going through life with as a healthy, fit, athletic person of optimal body composition and a very high level of awareness to eating healthy foods and so forth? And would you attribute your sensitivity to genetics, or was there something like, and might be asking this question on behalf of millions of, you know, active exercising folks who consume a lot of carbohydrates, burn a lot of carbohydrates, look athletic, healthy, and fit on the outside, but are baking up pre-diabetic. Timothy Noakes, the famous exercise physiologist from South Africa, being the most prominent example of someone who was, you know, running ultra marathons, you know, working in at the highest level of his field, and one of the world's foremost experts on athletic training and nutrition and diet. And he basically had to throw everything in the garbage can and change his life because he himself was on a disease path rather than a healthy path.
Yeah, for sure. Well, a few years ago, like when I started to, you know, develop my own personal health issues. So it was more so like I was experiencing like extreme fatigue, brain fog, and I had a lot of skin issues. So I was going to all these different doctors trying to figure out what was going on. But of course, they are more so providing that Band-Aid approach. And, you know, they weren't providing me with the answers that I was looking for. You know, I'm the type of person, I need to understand why something is happening.
Oh no, here comes Molly again for her appointment. Okay, get ready. Here, just take these pills and get out of here. No. I got another question. I got another one.
Yeah. So I was just increasingly frustrated. Like I thought back to the reason I like became interested in this in the first place was my professor had brought in a glucose meter one day during my internship, and she asked for volunteers to test their blood sugar. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. It was a fasting blood sugar. And I had no idea at the time, but I was one of the only people in the class, along with the other guy, that had not eaten anything. So technically we were in a fasted state. So again, we're looking for fasting values. So this is like being 8 hours without food, where our levels are at baseline. We want to be in that 70 to 90 range. And my levels were at 108 milligrams per deciliter for, you know, when I did my finger prick. And of course, my professor voiced her concerns to me. She was like, Molly, you need to go to a doctor and check on this. But I didn't at the time. But it always was ruminating in the back of my head. And as I started to feel, you know, I didn't feel well, like, you know, years down the road with my brain fog, my skin issues. And again, nothing was making sense. I kind of had that, you know, light bulb moment. Oh, maybe I should get a glucose meter and start testing my blood sugar, which I did. And, you know, I started seeing all the signs of high fasting levels, high postprandial responses. So for me, it just opened up this awareness and at least provided some sort of gratification that like I at least found something, right? I was going to these doctors and they weren't able to give me any sort of answer. So me knowing that something was not right, and I could explicitly see that through glucose testing, opened up my world to a lot of different things. And I further discovered that I had polycystic ovarian syndrome. So it's PCOS, basically just a hormonal imbalance, but it's very common for females with PCOS to have poor blood sugar regulation, and about 70% of the PCOS population are insulin resistant. So this kind of opened up my eyes to all of these things. You know, we're referring to the South African, you know, doctor or whatever, he he was like an athlete and everything. And I grew up playing sports too, but I was eating more so like plant-based because that's kind of what was drilled into our head with, you know, being in school and our internship. But I quickly altered my perspective on that. And I think my own health experience, you know, promoted that change, but I started incorporating, you know, more meat and, you know, more animal-based products into my diet, and I started feeling significantly better. So it was, I was eating a high carb diet, which is a plant-based diet. Well, not wholly, but like mostly. And it now, you know, in hindsight, that makes complete sense why, you know, my blood sugar was out of control. And, you know, I know now if I eat carbohydrate, you know, and I was eating in the morning, afternoon, and at night, my blood sugar is probably consistently just like out of control. So it was very eye-opening for me personally. And I think, you know, it's the perfect example of, you know, you could be this fit, you know, athlete or anything, and, you know, you cannot maybe be so healthy on the inside. So again, we have a ton of athletes that come to NutriSense too. And not everyone has the great, you know, metabolic control that they would suspect that they have. So I think, you know, that's a truly fascinating aspect of glucose monitoring for sure.
Now, do you see a ton of individual variation where the next person through the door can be slamming carbs all day long, hitting the gym and turning in their numbers, and they have a beautiful, you know, stability and quick return to baseline after meals?
For sure. There's, you know, there's plenty of people that, you know, they can eat carbs at night. They can, you know, eat more processed foods and have a normal response to it. So they just are metabolically, you know, more flexible and more tolerant of these types of foods. But yeah, there's definitely then the people that come on like me and just their blood sugar is out of whack. So, you know, that's why I suggest at least trying, you know, monitoring your blood glucose at some point just to see, right? Just to, you know, if you are in a good place, that's awesome. You know, maybe check again in a year from now and, you know, see how your body changes, because your glucose can, you know, be manipulated through so many different things. So it's just an important variable or metric to monitor. But yeah, it's truly dependent on the individual for sure.
And again,
let's talk about nootropics. These are supplements designed to improve cognitive function, memory, and creativity. And I'm taking three products from a company called NU Optimal. The products are MetaFocus, which promotes flow state and improves processing speed and mental clarity. It contains ingredients like phenylalanine, B12, ginkgo biloba. I'm taking MetaMemory, which is good for memory retention, verbal fluency, reduced oxidative stress, very important for the brain. This product has things like lion's mane, pine bark, and bacopa. And I'm taking MetaDrive for motivation, stress resilience. It's got a little boost of caffeine in there, ashwagandha, rhodiola. They're wonderful products with a lot of scientific detail and easy to understand information on their website. So you get the big picture of what these products are all about, not just stuffing pills down your face, but how to do the stack, as they call it, strategically. You get a 16-page booklet that'll guide you to optimal use when you purchase. And guess what? 60-day money-back guarantee and 30% discount from me. Listen, I'm not a coffee guy. I'm not a drug guy, but I'm always looking for any type of natural edge I can get, especially for cognition. So guess what? Let's avoid that sugary junk food. Let's get enough sleep. Take a power nap when you need one. And consider trying some nootropics to see if you get a natural brain boost. So go visit newoptimal.com, NUOPTIMAL, and enter the code BRAD30 to get 30% discount when you try it. newoptimal.com for way more details.
probably most of us listening have had annual physical or had our blood drawn once in a while. And if you think about the sum total of all the blood glucose readings of your whole life, you know, if you go to the doctor once a year for a physical and here's 27 years of blood readings, you're going to get that amount in a single day with the sensor. And so the data is so much more relevant than a snapshot from one visit to the physician once in a while, especially as it relates to these nuances like sleep and everything. So you're saying you're you want to see a fasting blood glucose in the range of 70 to 90, and that seems quite low for me. Are you saying this is a goal that all of us should aspire to? That's going to be a high score, and anything over that is something to look at? Or is there some variation there too, where this person is supremely healthy, even though they're at 100 in a fasted state?
Yeah, there's definitely nuances to fasting levels. And of course, like what I was saying, I put more emphasis on glycemic variability and postprandial responses, because it is normal to see variation levels, you know, on a daily basis. And especially if you're just going to your doctor and getting that single finger prick, like what if you had a super high carb meal right before bed and you slept horribly, then you go get your finger prick and it's at like 110. That could just be that day, right? That's just one instant in time. Whereas with the continuous glucose monitor, you can see maybe your glucose isn't always like that, and it's more so just a factor of one sort of manipulation that you can make there with your, you know, evening meal. So there are nuances there. And yes, like ideally, you know, staying, if you want, you know, to reach optimal health, like staying in that 70 to 90 range is a good bet. But it doesn't mean that if your levels are, you know, I mean, mine are, you know, it doesn't mean that I am in super poor health, right? There's other factors that can be playing in there. And conventionally, they just want levels, you know, to be at least below 100. So I guess there's like optimal versus like what is probably okay. And then, you know, what gets into more where negative implications can come about. So I don't want to like put that pressure on someone to think like, oh, if my levels are not in the 70 to 90 range, I'm sick, or, you know, something bad is going to happen. It's just, there's so many other working parts to our health. And, you know, I never want to focus solely on one thing. And if, you know, if that's something that's difficult that, you know, to fix, then, you know, I will focus more so on something that we can, you know, what is it in our control and what can we fix? So,
right. Yeah. If there's no reported, you know, adverse consequences of someone, you know, cooking up 100 every morning. And I'm reminding myself of my experience when I was working on the keto reset diet and going deep, deep into the ketogenic diet and monitoring my carbohydrates and eating less than 50 grams a day and fasting for long periods of time. And I would routinely have morning blood glucose, fasted blood glucose values that were over 100. 110, 121, 117, 93, 87, 109. And I was like, what's going on here? I haven't put any carbs in my body for a long time. And that's when we have a bigger picture here of like, if I'm, you know, greatly restricting my carbohydrates and I'm going out there and doing high difficulty, high intensity workouts, I'm certainly going to be making my own glucose to fuel my exercise habits and whatever else I need to do to get through the day. And so, you know, that's when you realize that this is just a gateway to more information and more measuring. And then, you know, seeing how well did you feel like you slept that night? And if it's a thumbs up or thumbs down, then you can go back, look at the numbers and see what's going on. And you mentioned briefly someone doing an intervention of, well, let's ask, you know, could we have this athlete sitting down for a sweet potato at 7 p.m. as part of their strategy to sleep better because it worked a few times and it's validated by the numbers?
Yeah, for sure. And what you're saying with, you know, that if you're following a more of a strict keto diet, it's very common, you know, and we see this more. It's physiological insulin resistance. So it's like this adaptive glucose string that you know, arises for individuals who are, you know, on a ketogenic diet or very low carb diet for extended periods of time. So we do see that rise in fasting levels. And I don't think there's enough research on it at this point to indicate whether or not it's, you know, particularly a bad thing. But in my eyes, if everything else is great, you know, metabolically, if you, you know, get your labs tested and everything looks okay, and that's kind of like that one indicator that seems offset, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. So
You mentioned that you want to see, I mean, that was a big statement, that you pay more attention to postprandial glucose than fasting. And so that kind of redirects us nicely to our meal choices and how we do in the aftermath. But you said you want to see a return to baseline in 2 to 3 hours. And that strikes me as quite a long time. You know, 3 hours after lunch, I would hope that I'm still not in this, you know, glucose processing state. But, you know, maybe you can describe that time window from what the research says and why it seems so long to the layperson here talking.
Right. So when you eat something, like, it can, your glucose may not hit its peak till maybe like an hour and a half or something. So if you think about it, you know, it should be hitting it in that first hour or so, and then start to come back down. But it takes longer than you think to start rising. I think that's kind of the nuance there, right? So then, you know, coming back down, I would say for the most part, in generally healthy people, they come back down in that 2 to 3 hour frame. So
when you have a pineapple flavored hot fudge sundae with a Slurpee, it's still going to take a while to have an extreme spike in glucose?
If it's pure carbohydrate, just straight sugar, usually I will see, that's usually when I'll see like a spike, and then it'll come down faster because it's easily processed. When there's other macronutrients involved, so if there's fat involved or, you know, protein, the fat delays how the glucose is infiltrating into our bloodstream. So say you have a high fat, high starch meal like pizza, right? You eat that, you have a super high spike. Since there's fat in there, it's delaying how that carbohydrate is being processed. So then that's when we see that larger area under the curve through the glucose response. And it's typical to see like 4+ hours until you return back to baseline from those situations. And if you think about it, your body's working hard to process that carbohydrate, but then also the fats in the mix, like slowing it down. So it can take longer. And, you know, then there's the alternative, right? Where, you know, if you eat something like an apple and you eat it, like probably your glucose is going to spike, come back down relatively quickly. But if you do have that spike, you can add something like protein, or, you know, so maybe you do like a hard boiled egg in addition to that apple, and you might see you probably will see a far more mitigated glucose response. So the protein pretty much like mitigates the response. Fat can be helpful as well, like in those smaller portion sizes. But I would say the fat plus starch, like from more processed food, is what are the worst responses. But the fat and protein can be helpful with like more simple whole foods, if that makes sense.
Well, we know not to eat hyper palatable processed foods combining processed carbohydrate and fat, not only because of what our reading says, but because they hijack the dopamine receptors on the brain and they lead to addictive behavior toward those foods. And if you can think of the top 20 indulgent, popular treats, desserts, they're all pretty much throwing in processed carbs and fat. So you have ice cream, potato chips, and so on down the line, milkshake, whatever. But I guess just to drill down a little more, you're going to just grab an apple in the afternoon for a healthy snack as a healthy person. How do we compare, contrast that with having a soda at 3 p.m. versus the apple?
Right. So with like sugar is sugar, and our body's going to respond to it. So with the Coke, you know, or probably going to have a blood sugar response, but it's the influx of the amount of carbohydrates at once. So with an apple, if you think about it, there's fiber in the mix, right? And it's a natural food source. So there are working components in that food that is, you know, natural, and our body, you know, knows how to break that down, versus a Coke. There's probably, you know, it's so many more carbohydrates coming in at once that our body has that, you know, most of the time has that higher blood sugar response. So there is a difference in the composition of more processed meals versus more whole foods, right? So obviously I'm going to, you know, if someone's having a spike from Coke, I would say, you know, an apple is a better response in general because it is a more natural food source. But of course, someone might have a higher spike from that. So then, you know, the next step would be, okay, how can we manage that spike then from the apple? And, you know, that's when that protein pairing and the whole idea of like no naked carbs consumed at once can be helpful. So pairing it with a, you know, a protein or fat to help modulate that response.
So we're envisioning this graph. When you open up your app, you see a graph of the glucose numbers going through the hours of the day. So it's like a Richter scale for the earthquake. And we're not necessarily looking for just a flat line, but we kind of want to have, if there is a spike, we want to bring it back within that 2 to 3 hours. And also I would imagine we don't want to see any dips well below baseline, because that implies an insulin response maybe from the soda. So would that be one of the compare contrasts with the apple and the hard-boiled egg, where you're going to get a spike anytime you eat anything, but then it's going to kind of gracefully slide down the bunny slope back to norm, versus this Richter scale where you're taking a dive after the soda?
Yeah, definitely. So that's the whole idea of reactive hypoglycemia. And we see it often with more processed or a larger influx of carbohydrates at once. So your body responds to that influx by producing, you know, more insulin maybe than it should. And so you do see that spike, but then you see that huge plummet. Then afterwards, it's dipping super low into more hypoglycemic ranges. And if someone, I see that happen, I ask someone, you know, did you experience any symptoms at this point? Yes. Then, you know, this is something that's definitely not, you know, a good meal that you should be eating. But I mostly see that reactive hypoglycemic response with more processed foods than a more whole food. And, you know, that protein combination is very helpful for that aspect.
But I have heard thrown around here and there, you made one mention of it, where you have certain, I would say, weird sensitivities to what is seemingly a healthy food in the health category on the chart on the wall. So some people do fine with a sweet potato, and some people do terribly, but they do fine with a pineapple. Is that validated by the data that you've seen from all your members and from research?
What, that you think it's more so like a sensitivity to the food?
Yeah, like here's 100 grams of carbohydrates in a bowl of brown rice. Here's 100 grams in a pineapple, cottage cheese, blueberry, a bowl. And one, the same person responds, you know, adversely to one versus the other.
Yeah, like it's hard to detect like sensitivities, and I see it rarely, because in my mind, I'm like, is it a sensitivity or are you just poorly responding to the carbohydrate? Right. Mm. And I think it's more, you know, there's so many working variables, but it could be hormonal and degrees of insulin resistance at play. So I think for the most part, you know, in my case, for example, you know, I may have a, you know, smaller degree of insulin resistance because I cannot tolerate that carbohydrate well. So it's just earlier signs of it. Whereas someone who is metabolically healthy, they can tolerate it well. Right. And there's, it's truly is just dependent on the individual and how they respond. So that's why testing is the best way to go, and just see how you respond and recover based on, you know, your own body. So
Okay, here's a weird one from my wife, Mia Moore's data. And I'm curious if you see anticipatory drops in glucose before a meal or anticipatory spikes before a meal, where we think we were reading the data accurately and going, wait, that was an hour before we sat down and had food after a long period of time. I wonder if any of there's weird things that people report and can't get explained, and if you see some trends where you're answering the same question frequently.
Well, with the lower dips, I would say, yeah, like you, a lot of the time someone might feel hungry at this time, and that could be associated with those lower dips. So my suggestion there would be, you know, eating something to help alleviate that. With a glucose spike, that's more interesting. And I would say there might be another variable at play. So, you know, were you exercising, or was there heat involved or something else? But I usually won't see a spike, like an anticipatory spike, but I'll see a dip, which promotes that hunger. I'm trying to think of other things that, you know, someone might be curious about with when they're, you know, measuring their glucose state. And I think a lot of the times, you know, especially because we have a lot of keto and carnivore people, so they try out a lot of the keto products, right? So think that because it says keto on the label that, you know, you can eat it and you're not going to have a blood sugar response, but there's so many nuances to that. And I think it's a lot of time we'll get super confused because I'll eat these keto products and they still see a glucose response, and other people, they might not. So and again, it's just more indication. It's just like, it's still at the end of the day is a processed food. Right. So, and you know, some people,
this show is sponsored by Keto Snacks. Here's a commercial. Eat this thing in a package or box or wrapper and you'll be fine. Don't worry.
Yeah. But yeah, we see it all the time. And, you know, I always encourage someone to try them out, because if you know, it's not the best response, and maybe you should, you know, remove it and replace it with more of a whole food product, right? That's the ideal here, that we're focused on more whole foods.
And this show is sponsored by Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, a whole food product that's delicious. It's a wonderful snack, and it probably won't spike your glucose unless you have a weird sensitivity to it. Tell me about how heat, dehydration, and a workout might show up on your chart, how it plays out with blood glucose.
Yeah, so
not all together. I'm saying each one. We don't want to go and work out and get dehydrated, but you mentioned heat, which I have no idea how that might influence blood glucose, so I threw that in. But I also think dehydration could be something that has a profound response, and then workouts in general.
Yeah, so heat, especially now that it's been summertime, I've seen spikes all the time. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's more so, I believe it's through, like, we're measuring the interstitial fluid with the continuous glucose monitor. So it's something with fluid alterations there. But, you know, someone might have a spike from being outside, you know, sunbathing, but that's not a concern to me. It's something I see all the time. So heat's fine. Even if you go take a shower or you're in a sauna, very normal to see that glucose spike. With dehydration, I see it with, if I'm looking at an exercise, for example, that's sometimes, you know, something that I'll suggest. If, you know, they're working out in a fasted state, you know, it's normal to see a glucose response from a higher intensity exercise. And, you know, it's our body, you know, producing the hepatic glucose output that's fueling that exercise. So it's a normal thing. It's not a bad thing. It's, you know, it's not insulin mediated. So a glucose response from a workout is different than a glucose response from food. But with hydration, that's something that I'll consider if someone is having a higher spike and they're trying to get it down and they're concerned, even though it might not be super concerning. Hydration status can be helpful there. So, you know, fueling with electrolytes and more, you know, water, of course, can be helpful there. And it's definitely something that is seen, but it's, you know, not as often. with exercise, as I was discussing, it's normal to see a response from that. With higher intensity exercises, it is normal to see a spike, but generally speaking, we want to keep levels at least below like 180. So beyond that, like say if you're doing a workout, it's super high intensity and you hit 200, there is, you know, there can be blood vessel damage that's occurring at this point. So I would either suggest, you know, lowering the intensity, or we can work in manipulating or adding in, you know, fuel beforehand. You know, I usually experiment with fasted state versus carbohydrate beforehand versus, you know, just a protein source beforehand. So everyone kind of varies depending on, you know, the different factors. So I just like to experiment. I'm just because I've seen so much data and there's no, you know, direct correct answer for anyone. So exploration is really the only answer. And we can only discover that through trying out these different things. So it's super exciting when someone is open to that and we can actually see the effects. So, but with, you know, so that's with higher intensity exercises, seeing those spikes, but with more low intensity. So something like walking, or if you're going really slow on the elliptical or something like that, it's normal to see a glucose dip. It helps dispose of any excess glucose. So for example, if you have a high spike after a meal, walking is an excellent way to help bring those levels back down sooner, especially later on at night when we have a decreased insulin sensitivity in general. It's going to be harder. It's more likely to see that larger area under the curve. So, you know, that walk after your dinner time meal, even if it's 10 minutes, can be super effective in bringing your glucose levels down. So, and then with more like strength training, it depends on the intensity as well, but usually I'll just see like a small budge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is difference in, you know, low intensity strength training, you know, more aerobic, high intensity training. So if someone does test out their blood sugar and they do see a spike in, you know, from exercise, it's completely normal and expected. And, you know, we just want to avoid hitting those super, super high levels. So
You mentioned area under the curve a couple times. That scientific term, it might be defined as spending as little time as possible in that no man's land where your blood glucose is higher than your baseline and it's lingering there for hours after the meal. So I guess the goal is to kind of tighten that area under the curve. Is that an accurate definition there?
Yeah. So for thinking conceptually, like if we're looking at data, you know, if you see a spike that, you know, hits 110 and then it comes back down in 2 hours, you know, that's a smaller area under the curve versus if you have a spike to, you know, 155 and then it's sitting up there and then it comes down in a lower, you know, area. There's a larger portion under that curve. So that's that area under the curve. So we want to have like more, a tighter regulation of that. So again, that just plays into how we're processing the meal.
Molly, we got a lot of info to sort out here. What a great great talk. Thank you so much for taking the time. I think people will be highly interested in learning more at NutriSense. I have a discount for my listeners. I'll convey that. And the one thing that I'm curious about, as the 27 dietitians are there waiting for new members to join, this to me, I believe it's a very formal education. In whether you're getting a degree in nutrition, certified dietitian, which is way more studying, we're kind of talking about USDA, American Dietary Association, very traditional type of you know, methodology. And so I'm wondering, it sounds like you did a little bit of your own journey, especially with your own health problems. But when people emerge from this area of training, how does that kind of pair up with the progressive health or the ancestral health movement?
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately we're all like, as dietitians, we're all certified under the same, you know, umbrella. And right, this is a field that is new. So we don't expect, you know, the new dietitians that coming in, like maybe they have more experience in functional medicine or integrative medicine, But a lot of it comes through like self-exploration, and there's so much information out there now. So it's just that person who's going to go out there and, you know, search for more information through, you know, listening to podcasts or books or, you know, any other way to explore, you know, more reasonings behind everything. So again, we're the dietetics field, we're trained under these, you know, certain, you know, regulations, but it just takes the people who are, you know, have that curious mind to explore other ideas. So yeah, it's, we've formed an excellent team. It's so much fun, and it's exciting watching everything grow. So.
And when you're interacting one-on-one with a client, I suppose you're stopping short of dictating dietary recommendations or a certain diet. And if they announce that they're plant-based high carbohydrate eater, you're just going to kind of help them analyze the data. And I don't know, maybe make some gentle suggestions about, just like you said, protein pairing and things like that. And then they can take it and run with it. Just to be clear, it's not like you're, it's not the NutriSense diet. It's the NutriSense technology helping you sort out whether this crazy diet that you've decided to follow is contributing to your health, or could be a red flag or a yellow flag, as you call it.
Exactly. Like, we don't promote any sort of diet. We promote, you know, what works for that individual person. So we base it off of what we're seeing in the data, their health history, and, you know, we make our recommendations from there. But we trust, you know, it's always, we want to work with the person, you know, where they're at, and, you know, we make our suggestions based off of that. So we're never like forcing anything upon anyone. We're just purely providing that data, providing the education, giving the information that we know. And, you know, maybe they might not, it might not resonate with them like right then and there, but like maybe 2 years from now, they'll be like, oh yeah, I forgot I did that, and I learned this, and I was not responding. Maybe I should make this change now. So it is just, it's information for the person to, you know, make better decisions for their health.
No, so. Yeah, no judgment, just a 3 out of 10 score for that bag of dried mangoes that you killed on the drive home from Costco. No offense, just here it is on your chart. Thank you very much. Oh boy. Molly Downey, great show. Listeners can learn more at NutriSense, NutriSense. And I think it was super fun. Keep up the great work. Thanks for listening, everybody.
So great talking to you, Brad.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba.
I want to tell you about Inside Tracker, an awesome new ultra-personalized nutrition and lifestyle program that combines data from your comprehensive blood panels, genetic test results, and lifestyle and fitness data from a Fitbit, for example, and organizes everything into one super cool online portal of your personal health. I am just getting going with this, and it's awesome. It has everything in one spot. For every blood result, you can click on a blog post or watch a video to learn more about these values. It's a great education in general health and self-quantification, and it was developed by leading scientists in aging, genetics, and biometric data from MIT, Tufts, and Harvard. The patented Inside Tracker algorithm calculates your so-called inner age, and it shows each biomarker as either optimized, needs to improve, or at risk. And then you can take precise corrective action with a science-backed plan to reach your performance goals. Oh, mercy, people. On my first round of testing, guess what my inner age was? 62! Shocker! Because I just turned 56. I'm sorry. You know what? When I delivered that blood test, I believe I was a little overtired, and several of my biomarkers were deemed to be subpar. So I made some changes as directed. I recovered better, rested, went back, and delivered way better numbers at the next blood test. The Inside Tracker motto is, change is an inside job, and that is for real. You got to keep tabs on this stuff to be at your best. And they have an amazing deal just for BRAD podcast listeners. They are going to give away a grand prize of $1,500 in Inside Tracker value. So to enter, all you have to do is go to insidetracker.com/BRADPOD, BRADPOD. Check it out right now at the link and enter the contest.
Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.